Well, hi, everybody, and welcome. Thank you for the number of responses and questions you've sent in. I want to divert a little bit from the outline to answer some questions and sort of wrap in some initial discussion with some responses to some excellent questions that have evolved from the first three seminars. So I will be deviating a bit from the outline. First, any questions or additions or any comments you'd like to make before we go on mute and record? We're on record, but before we go on mute, anything you'd like to add or ask or highlight at this point? Well, again, the invitation still is there, even after the final seminar now, this time. I still welcome any questions or comments that you have. So I'm going to go on mute for the background noise, record, and I'll come back for a discussion mode at the end. Okay, we're going to talk in this seminar about updating your operating system, about writing new stories. And specifically, based on some of the questions and comments, I want to add some strategies of creating successful change and applying what we're talking about even more to mentor coaching. So initially, a couple of questions that I want to ask back to you. What do you do to establish an optimum mindset to begin a session with a client? And related to that, are there ways that you enter specific mindsets for tasks or performance, such as a presentation, for working out, for writing? And consider, how does mindset framing impact what you do and whatever performance it is and your effectiveness in that? And a final question that can bring these into a more specific container, why not focus on problems in order to resolve or remove them? Now, what we know is that problems go down existing pathways. When someone begins to talk about problems, creating solutions, those are existing pathways in the brain. That's how people get stuck at times in therapy, by going down existing pathways, trying to find ways to solve or resolve them. Possibilities create a very new connection, new neural connections and pathways. So as your client may begin with, well, the problem is this, you may want to redirect the focus to look at possibility, because that creates new neuronal connections and pathways in the brain. And by focusing on now and next, on possibility, I think it can be a very different kind of conversation. And when you do this with a client, you're creating the choice architecture at this moment of looking at possibilities, at solutions, of creating new and different experiences, even though it won't be as comfortable, there's not the certainty of going down a problem pathway. But we get what we focus on. Let me give you a very simple application of that. My wife and I did the BMW Performance Racing School for 3 days. We worked with professional racers. The very first thing, the first day in our driving challenge was going around turns at high speeds, and the first thing the professional told us, don't look at what you want to avoid. Look at where you want to go. We always get what we focus on. If you look at what you want to avoid, you'll hit it every time. Same thing with our work in mentor coaching with clients. Appreciative inquiry is a whole field of study that focuses on what works and knowing that a focus on what works enhances what works, and it awakens possibility. So this is a much more effective way to practice in order to improve performance, or simply to engage with a client in creating a new story. So let's look first at the brain's story of self. Our brains show us exactly where in that anatomy the sense of self resides, the medial prefrontal cortex. This is the part of the brain that lights up when people self-reflect, they make assessments and judgments regarding themselves, and here are some self-reflection prompts. Focus on the story that the source inside tells. Tell your story in a way that engages what you want in order to actualize it. Plan it, map it, tell it, then initiate its creation. This is exactly what we do in coaching, to focus on what someone wants to co-create with us. So whatever you're living or experiencing in any way is a response to this story. If you want the story to change, you have to change the way you tell that story so that it shifts your feeling and thinking as you're telling it. This means that responses from others are not in this equation of the creation. This new telling has to align with who you are. Here's what you'll notice with every client, and this is a bit of a reiteration of what we've talked before. Every time your client takes a step into a new, a different, a change in any way, it's attendant with some kind of trepidation, uncertainty, simply the lack of certainty of what's going to happen next. So this needs to be interpreted as the opportunity, the challenge, the excitement, not the anxiety of danger, but the excitement of moving ahead. When the client creates change, then we can help them understand that this is a part of a process of transformation. They're changing their operating system, who and how they are. This is an important component, because unless this is part of change and transformation, someone will revert back to their original position. We always return to our identity. That means that our identity, the bedrock of how and who we are, needs to evolve with the changes that we make in our lives, in our behaviors, in what we do. And this is what we can help someone align this experience of the newness with being a signpost of being in new territory, of doing something different, and incorporating that as part of how and who they are now as they're transforming how they think and experience and behave. So when this engagement of full energy of someone going in the same direction, when they're fundamental components of needs and ideals aligns with strategy and story. This is what we want to be sure we're aware of and helping a client become aware of. When needs and ideals align with strategy and story, all of the client is going in the same direction, and we can help them incorporate those changes to understand and come to see the change internally as well as behavior. So to know that you can keep living and telling a better story no matter how good your story is, that's the growth mindset. Let's look for a minute at pre-commitment. And you know this story. In the Odyssey, Odysseus and his men are sailing home from the Trojan War. He's been warned about the sirens, whose seductive song leads sailors to destruction, but he wants to hear it anyhow. So he does two things. He gives his men earplugs and give them orders that they tie him to the mast and ignore all of his pleas for release until they're safely past danger. This management of desire invented pre-commitment to inoculate against a predictable and potentially, in that case, fatal future desire. Willpower alone might not have been enough, and Odysseus knew that no one is immune to temptation. So pre-commitment can be especially useful when it comes to things like repetitions or habits or obvious weaknesses. These are things that we can help a client become aware of and create as part of a new system, a new map of exactly what they want to do. So the coordinates of each coaching story, where they are, where they want to go, this is part of a larger picture of an evolution of how they see themselves and how their even identities are changing. And this can allow also the consideration of commitment devices for a client to create a self-accountability as well as an accountability partner as we are in coaching. And there have been studies that show how people self-impose as well as co-create commitments for behaviors that they know are in their best interest. You know, think about how we help our kids do this. A piggy bank. It's a commitment device to counter impulsive purchases. Other ways that people counter their own vulnerability and bolster commitment to a better response. Some alcoholics take antabuse, a pill that makes them sick if they drink. In one study, college students were given the option to create their own earlier deadlines for three papers due by the end of the semester. 75% of them jumped at this chance and did it. Now, when you think about it, 100% of them could have done that at any time and created their own deadlines. So this simply made them aware of how they can look at a commitment and fulfill that commitment and the experience of it. People find ways of saving themselves from immediate cravings. A study at Harvard Business School looked at the ways people dealt with purchasing products they wanted versus products they needed or should have, in their view. They would devise ways to put off purchasing or even having delivered the wanted products to ensure they would do what they should do first. One goofy remedy a colleague of mine suggested to certain of his clients, this was a financial advisor, freezing a credit card in ice to mandate a contemplative pause before a purchase. Or think about even how automatic retirement fund deposits from your checking account, X amount the first day of every month from your checking account to your retirement account. One simple decision that can have lasting impact and is a commitment device. So this reframes what people want and should do. It reframes it to make it their own story. And that becomes a powerful aspect of the experience of effectiveness. So let's think about how we can help a client engineer effectiveness in their own performance. One is, and you may have experienced this, you may experience clients having this, a thought loop, a negative thought loop, is simply replaying the same thoughts, reviewing the same scenarios over and over. You can't find an exit. Or whenever there's a particular challenge, a particular emotional trigger, they will immediately engage in a negative thought loop, whether that's negative self-talk or other things that seem to just keep happening, and they feel powerless over that. So the thought loop may include things like, well, if only I had done this, or this is what I should have said. So This is a way of triggering an automatic response. Usually, the cue, the emotional cue, is what you perceive as something that's maybe not even overtly or consciously anxiety-provoking or challenging, and there's an emotional cue that's a state change, and all the content of that negative thought loop or all the negative self-talk, that's a time capsule. And think about how that time capsule has not changed over time. And we talked in a previous seminar about one simple way to engage this is self-directed neuroplasticity. Three simple steps. Whenever you have that negative thought loop, the triggering of something that's just a repetition and has no future is simply depleting, to recognize that as an error message from your brain. If we repeat something enough times, it will hardwire it, and it will become the truth. That's why people who say the same lie over time will be able to pass a lie detector test. Our brains reflect the repetition, not the veracity. So whatever the negative thought loop is, whatever the negative thought is, simply recognize it as an error message from your brain in order immediately to reframe it to here and now and a positive engagement to refocus on the next step. So these three simple steps, recognize, reframe, and refocus. Recognize the error message of your brain. It's just doing its job description. Refocus, reframe to what exactly you want to do. What is the now task? And to refocus on the next step. And that seems so simple, but yet it can be elusive. And think about how so many of the different ways to enter that negative thought loop, the mechanism is the same in most instances. It involves stopping a present experience. And instead of the next step being engaging what you do, even though it's new or different, stopping yourself with a signal of anxiety and then moving into that same repetition, that negative thought loop. And that can be simply looking at stopping yourself and then declaring that's procrastination. And it's like, well, I don't need to examine it anymore. I've diagnosed it. I'm a procrastinator. That can be something as simple as referring to what you do as a habit of stopping yourself. It can be calling yourself an imposter because there's a signal of a bit of anxiety because you're doing something new and different. Think about when you had your first sample session, your first true coaching session as a coach. The anxiety, if you had interpreted that, if you had stopped yourself and then interpreted it as, well, I'm an imposter, or I can't do it, or I need to start over and do this next Tuesday. Any one of these are results of stopping yourself, to procrastinate, to feel an imposter, to do anything other than proceed is simply a reaction to stopping yourself and making it make sense so that it doesn't seem so discombobulating. So this is something, so let's review some of the essentials in this framework of affecting significant change, or just simply engineering basic effective change. One, and this is in your, we're back to the outline now. This is in your outline. focus specifically on the next step. Some of you have heard me tell this story. Terry Fox started the Marathon of Hope. It's a cross-Canada run of 3,339 miles. Because he had an artificial leg, his running style was a shuffle and a hop. He managed to average 24 miles a day, completed the run in 143 days. Immediately after the race, he was interviewed to ask how did he keep going when he was exhausted and had thousands of miles ahead. He said, "I just kept running to the next telephone pole." It was a simple next step. Now he knew where the telephone poles were going. They ended at the end of the Marathon of Hope, but all he did was go to the next telephone pole. Secondly, specify the next step. Not abstract, not global, not zooming out, but zooming in. Some is not a number. Soon is not a time. Act healthier is not a strategy. What's the first step? Three, make changes tangible and concrete. So this is where the map is important to determine where you are and where you're going to be able to measure progress along the way. That also can help you determine what's detour and distraction. But measuring progress, whether that's in a 20-minute sample session, in a 50-minute mentor coaching session, it helps you guide the successive approximation to the goal, in this instance, that your client has determined. Four, make progress measurable. A specific destination, a tangible focus on the next step. And make progress visible, specific, small, specific, attainable milestones. They can be visible with celebration of each small victory. This is the acknowledgement and the collaboration that you and the client have when they have a successful move, something that they've accomplished. You both are looking at that because this is the process of self-reflection and self-affirmation that the client is internalizing so that ultimately they won't need you. This process of the self-awareness and self-reflection being able to validate, to recognize and validate their steps and their progress and have that sense of effectiveness is self-rewarding, and that process can become ultimately internalized so that they do it in between times in the beginning of the sessions, but ultimately they do it without you, and that with that client is your legacy. Now, one example of shrinking a task to a tangible next step is Alcoholics Anonymous, challenging its members to one day at a time. It shrinks the change to a manageable, foreseeable, specific action. A small target can lead to small victories, the cumulative experience of effectiveness and mastery. And some members even do it an hour or a minute at a time and need to have that metric. The principle here: all you ever have to do is the next right thing. This shrinks change to an immediate step of effectiveness and the experience of momentum. So we've just adopted in this discussion the scientific method to examine, to measure, to test, to consider change, and look at the results. The scientific method is a challenge. To create a mindset of inquiry generates discomfort, but at the same time, it catalyzes growth. So let's look at what we're focusing on at this instant, at this juncture of what the client is creating this instant as they decide, the choice architecture. So here's process of making a choice, that whatever you think and feel and experience is what you create this moment. Whatever you experience, you either create or accept. So here are some things to think about and consider in our background, our backdrop of this, that we know and factor in to how we listen and engage in an understanding way. Increased tension produces emotional regression. It lowers the threshold so that somebody may be more impulsive, more prone to action, to looking at things in a negative way, or simply changing a state to result in the repetition and whatever's in that time capsule. Secondly, increased emotion narrows perspective. When emotion prevails or is in the foreground, focus can become narrower and more restricted to the most recent event. And paradoxically, when someone's in a state of upset and they're focused just on one thing and just on the recent thing, trying to use reason and logic when they're escalated in an emotional state actually makes it worse. It deepens their alarm pattern because it focuses even more on now and recent. So an escalated individual will further escalate, may dig in their toes, may spiral into more extreme responses and hurl themselves away from logic. So the first step is regulation of states of mind. Then to look together at planning a next step. So when you're, to say it a different way, when you're in a state of upset, the first order of business is to regulate feelings. So this may be, for someone who's in a state of upset, this may simply be to pause and to do nothing. It may be a challenge, especially, to not act at a time like this. So this is the Texas two-step, to pause, to get grounded and centered, and then respond. And it can be a significant challenge to pause, to get grounded and centered. It can be an instantaneous thing, and at a time of challenge, it can seem very elusive. Now, let's expand that to the to the Texas three-step. This is what we may do as coaches. The first step is to pause, to do nothing, to get grounded and centered ourselves, and then thirdly, to resonate with the client's experience so that they can get grounded and centered. Let me give you a simple example of this. I was working with a CEO of a regional facility. It was a healthcare facility of several states. And at one session, he mentioned that he had a horribly high attrition rate in their first responders, the people who were at the front desk of each of their clinics and places of healthcare, that their attrition rate in the last year had been 51%, just over half of people who were the first people that the patients coming in responded to, 51% left in a year's time. Now, this was a public facility, so they were challenged by all kinds of things like funding and you know, not enough people, all kinds of things. So I asked him a couple of questions. I said, what does a patient coming to the front desk usually say first thing to your person at that desk? He said, well, I don't know. I said, my other question, what does your person say in response to that? He said, well, I don't know, but I'll know by next time we meet. So he did a fairly extensive survey in a week's time. He said, here's the almost always answer. The first thing a patient will say is how much they're frustrated at the wait time, the tremendous time they've been waiting and how they've had to compromise things because there was just so much wait time and hurdles they had to go through just to get to that person at the front desk. And the person at the front desk almost inevitably began with an explanation of why that happened, because they were underfunded, understaffed, a whole number of things. But it was depleting the people. I said, here's what I'd suggest that you try. When that patient comes to the front desk person, that the first thing the front desk person says is a resonance with that experience. I hear how frustrated you are, or I understand you're upset. And then to say, let's look at what we can do now. So just two simple different sentences. We looked, it was 6 months later, so it's not a full measure, but in the first 6 months after that, the attrition rate was 6%, because the patients felt effective in being heard. The people who worked at the facilities felt effective in connecting with the patients and began to plan together so that they both had a sense of effectiveness and a reward for why they were doing that in the first place. The final answer is not in yet, but we're on the road. Now, here's an example of choice architecture from a different perspective. A study at a local car wash ran a promotion featuring loyalty cards. Each time a customer bought a car wash, they got a stamp on their card, and then when they filled their car with 8 stamps, they got a free wash. Now, another set, half of the customers, same car wash, got a loyalty card, but they needed to collect 10 stamps on this loyalty card rather than 8 to get a free car wash. But they were given a head start in that they received their cards, 2 stamps were already on there. So both were the same in essence. They both needed 8 car washes to get a free wash. Goal was the same, but the psychology and the motivation was very different. For those who had a head start with the 2 stamps, they were already 20% of the way toward a goal. Several months later, the results were in. 19% of the 8 stamp customers got a free car wash. 34% of the head start group got a free car wash. And not just almost twice as many did it, but this group that had the head start earned their free car wash faster, so they were ready to start over and spend more money sooner. So here's to keep in mind and how we resonate and collaborate with a client as they're reaching their goals and moving toward. People are motivated to be partly finished with a longer task or journey than to be just beginning an even shorter one. And people get more motivated and more excited as they see themselves getting closer to the goal. So this may help in terms of framing what they're doing and keeping that framework in mind to collaboratively review. So how you frame something can change the meaning, as we've discussed, to look at possibilities, not problems, to look at progress, not things that are fixed or far away. So meaning derives from the frame we place around an event or situation. This is how we create our stories and our own framework for this. An original experiment done by Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky had subjects spin a wheel that would stop supposedly at random numbers between 1 and 100. Then they were asked the percentage of African countries that belonged to the United Nations. Now, for one group of subjects, the wheel was preset to stop at 10. For the second group, it was preset to stop at 65. The first group, where it stopped at 10, guessed that 25% belonged to the United Nations. The second group guessed 45%. Now, the number on the wheel had no relation to the correct answer, but yet what the participants guessed had, the wheel had profound influence on the responses. So here it's important for us to recognize that even irrelevant information can influence judgments, which can then influence decisions. So what we're doing in coaching is to collaborate with someone in their decision making. So there are a lot of things to consider as we're listening to this and collaborating with clients in doing this. The way you frame a question can make a great deal of difference. Here's an example of that. When companies automatically enroll their employees in a retirement savings plan, the employee then has to opt out to not participate, to make a decision that says, I will not save for my future. When it's set up differently, where they're automatically enrolled, it's 100% initially, then this levels out to 94%. So at companies where it isn't automatic, someone has to choose to opt in 20%, a fourfold difference just in how it's framed. So, and this is, you probably heard this too, another example of how people are sensitive to things that shouldn't matter, but it's good to know what does matter. One group of countries in Europe has an option that people can donate their organs unless they check a box that says they don't want to. They have to opt out. They're automatically in, and they have to opt out. The rate of organ donation, 95%. Another group of countries have a form where if someone does donate their organs, unless they check the box, does not donate, unless they check the box to donate, they have to actively opt in. The rate of donation, 18%, over a fourfold difference here. So, to discern meaning, a specific meaning, you need a context. The frame can determine what you choose. The state of mind can determine the frame. We help our clients reframe. Someone has a setback, a disappointment, a crisis. Rather than continuing to focus on the upsetting issue, negative energy, or catharsis, this is not therapy and counseling, we reframe the situation after we resonate, perhaps, with the upset. What's the opportunity here? Problem to possibility. And when someone completes a list of options that they have or runs out of possibility, we may simply nudge, what else? Or is there more? Now, the reticular activating system at the base of the brain decides what's allowed into consciousness out of all the information streaming into the brain. There's always information coming in. What we selectively pay attention to, whatever fits our story, is the framework that we choose. For example, part of your story is your self-image. If someone says something really nice about you and you don't believe it, it may not register, or it'll be disavowed with, well, what are they trying to do or sell me? So how you reframe, how you reprogram your reticular activating system to let in what you want to achieve, consider natural filters, beliefs, self-image, goals. So one way to reprogram, especially if you're more visual, is a visualization, to create a systematic way of creating a vision of the successful attainment of a goal and of having affirmations that support that story. The visualization rewires your brain. The affirmations revise mind software. New behavior and new experiences create new pathways in your brain. And with each repetition, those pathways become more deeply etched. And then, with repetition, it becomes a habit, an automatic behavior, the default mode. Your future self lives in your present mind. If, for example, it's clearly visualized, then it's simply a matter of activating, actualizing that vision. So, one aspect of focus, where you have direct impact, what you can determine, where you can be effective, is your circle of influence. What you can't determine is your circle of concern. So, one prototype, basic thing that we may do with clients is to help them determine what they actually can be effective in doing and focus their energy on that rather than focusing their energy on what or who they want to change and finding frustration in that because they can't be effective in changing a partner, a boss, anyone else. And that can create a great deal of effectiveness. So we may help them simply look at that to determine what they can be effective in doing and to let go what they can't and put that energy into something where they can be effective. So this is this paradox occurs in every aspect of life. What you do not want, you may ironically make happen. Focusing on not making mistakes creates mistakes. Don't look at what you want to avoid when you're going around a turn at high speed. Focusing on not being late creates lateness. Focusing on not wanting to be financially insolvent creates a scarcity. And we're told focusing on not smoking makes smokers want to smoke. So your mind is an energy field and responds to focus. The unconscious does not know the difference between negative and positive, just the focus. The focus is the negative of the picture in your brain. And your mind precisely and effectively creates and follows then what you focus on. It's important, I think, to focus on what you do want rather than what you don't want, to put that way too simply. Secondly, become consciously aware so you can redirect the power of focus to the specific outcomes you want. One way, let me tell you another example from mentor coaching and an application of the focus. I worked with a CEO who had noticed that he had been totally preoccupied and thinking negatively for several months after a tragedy at his company, a tragedy where one person was killed, two people were seriously injured, and that had predominated his thinking, his worry, his concern since that time. And he had noticed that it had affected other people in the executive suite. And he was not able, he said, to not think about that. It was something he thought about every day. So, and he described how it was the first thing he thought about every morning. So, I just simply indicated to him that we began to ask ourselves questions as soon as we wake up, even if we're not consciously aware of what they are, we began to frame the day in that way. I suggested that he try something a bit different, that sometime during the day, or at least the night before he went to bed, that he write down three questions that would put him in a positive and empowered state of mind. Something very different than what he was thinking about, but not, I didn't describe it that way. I simply said something that would put you in a positive state of mind, something that you would feel empowered by answering these questions. Write the three down. Not what you want to, but what you want to go to, what you want to immediately experience. And he did that for a week. And the next time we met, he said, it's really amazing. I hadn't realized how that initial thought and concern and worry had framed so much of the day, and how different it is to frame it in a positive way. It engages something really different. My energy is different. I notice the people around me, my family and at work, are different. And we emphasize that it's not magical. It's simply how you frame something, and that can determine how you then create from that mindset what follows, and how, whenever there's a lapse into a negative thought, to immediately reframe, to look at the possibility, to refocus and reframe, to treat, if it's a return during the day, to treat that as an error message from your brain. He'd already done everything he could possibly do, so it wouldn't recur. So that's an error message. Then to reframe it, as he did with those initial questions, to then focus on the next step for exactly what he wanted to do after that. So one application here is that neuroscience offers us new insights about the relationship of motivation and performance incentives. Now, this has some relevance for how you and your clients determine goals, and specifically perhaps what those goals are. When brain activity is monitored during performance, the nucleus accumbens, the pleasure center, lights up whenever, as one metric, one way of looking at this, whenever money is gained or spent. This is simply a tangible example. So whenever money is gained or spent, it triggers dopamine. When financial incentives present a strong allure, reason as well as motivation can be swayed, can be diverted from their original intent. Now, this reward resembles the response to cocaine, meaning it has an addictive potential. The anticipation of cocaine or the anticipation of pleasure from some reward triggers the pleasure center to release dopamine, the chemical of pleasure and ecstasy. A monetary payoff can have the same effect as a small snort of cocaine. So, neuroscientists have found another brain paradox. I presented this in a keynote I did to a national nonprofit organization, and I saw a lot of open mouths when I did. The paradox is that what the pleasure center and the pain center are inversely related. In other words, the part of the brain that mediates social interactions, how we perceive and relate to others, is the posterior superior temporal sulcus. This part of the brain, the altruism center, lights up when we help others and form bonds. Now, here's the paradox. The pleasure center and the altruism center compete with one another. When one is in control or activated, the other turns off. In other words, when someone does something like a nonprofit charity work for altruistic reasons, the altruism center is firing. Then, if instead of the pleasure and the goodness of doing something, if money is offered for that same task, the altruism center shuts down and the pleasure center lights up. So here's an application. One large blood center, low on supplies for transfusions, decided to pay people to donate blood. Offering to pay decreased the number of donors by almost half. And they were baffled by this to start with. But what they found that reversed this effect, letting the donors contribute the payment to charity. The two centers in the brain competed. Another example, when daycare centers in Israel began fining parents for late pickups, the number of tardy parents essentially doubled. And they thought, what's going on? We're penalizing it, so they should avoid it, right? Well, the parents no longer felt ethically obligated to not inconvenience the teacher, because they then framed it as, well, they were paying the teachers to cover their lateness. So time became a commodity. Studies repeatedly show that a financial reward will undermine altruistic motivation. So when the pleasure center hijacks the altruism center, motivation changed dramatically to self-interest. So here's a final illustration of roadblocks to success. Darren Brown did an experiment in the UK in London on Regent Street, which has a lot of pedestrian traffic. Darren placed his wallet with money clearly sticking out of it on the sidewalk. He then drew a circle with yellow chalk around the wallet, sort of like the crime scenes on TV. Then he walked away, leaving the wallet lying there. Hundreds of people walked by that wallet. Almost every one of them saw it. Many stopped to look at it, but no one would pick it up, not a single person. The yellow chalk circle seemed to be a barrier that people were reluctant to cross. The yellow chalk circle created this barrier, an assumption that limited people from picking up the wallet. The question, do you have a yellow chalk circle? And a hint, it can be any assumption that limits you. So here's a summary of listening as mentor coaches. We become accustomed to listening, collaborating, co-creating a story without trying to fix it, give answers, or change the point of reference from the client to us. First, put your ego in a blind trust. In other words, don't take it personally. Listen to the language, whether it's active or passive. Listen to the point of reference, whether it's internal or external. Listen to the source of authority, whether it's self or other. Listen for the initiation of action, whether it's proactive or reactive. Listen for how centered the speaker is in his or her experience. And listen for the state of mind of the speaker and whether the state of mind is regulated and fits the task. So here are some elements of mentor coaching successful change. Just a brief overview, and these are in bullet form in your outline. We focus on collaborative co-creation, solutions rather than understanding why, possibilities rather than problems. Old patterns are hardwired, so it takes consistency of focus on new experiences to change that wiring. The first requirement is to claim ownership of the story, for the client to know it's their story, followed by recognition in order to understand, assess, and then change. Peter Drucker said, the most pressing task is to teach people how to learn. So let's review, just in brief overview, some important elements to mentor coach for successful change. Concentrate on new behaviors rather than problems in order to create new brain pathways. Identifying a problem won't solve it. Co-create new ways of thinking to stimulate brain circuits with an eye on the prize to lay new mental maps. Regulate a state of mind. This should be first. Regulate a state of mind and manage emotions to promote insight and co-creation involving left and right brain, intellectual and emotional. Facilitate insight rather than give advice or suggestions. Focus on successes rather than obstacles or non-performance. The power is in the focus. Emphasize positive adaptive behavior and progress. Discourage attention to negative behavior. Facilitate new behaviors and guide the development and actualization of new mental maps. Collaboratively conceptualize the mental map with a client so that the client is co-creating this experience to facilitate a new level of mastery. We commit to what we co-create. It's the IKEA effect I saw a couple of nights ago on The Irrational. The IKEA effect is we value more what we help build, I'm told. Remember that the power is in the focus and that permanent change arises from the consistency of that focus. In the event of diversion to an old feeling or behavior, redirect the ideas and energy flow to now and next. Knowledge conveyed passively is inert. Knowledge generated and created through insight changes mind and brain. And then finally, conceptualize a meta map with the client in order to master and internalize this process. This helps create a way to experience the effectiveness of change and to incorporate that into a conceptualization so that it's more retainable and attainable the next time in different ways. So, a couple of predictions going forward. I think we will develop engaging, innovative, new ways of recognizing and understanding synchronicities, individual and collective energy field, and a number of phenomena which are part of our experience and universe that in tomorrow's ahead, we will evolve concepts and better descriptive systems to deal with that. We'll develop words in a language, a nomenclature for things we can only sense right now, like collective energy fields, and stemming from Einstein's unified field theory of human behavior. The magician Harry Houdini reminded us, just because something is unexplained doesn't mean it's supernatural. And finally, to paraphrase Garrison Keillor, be happy, be well, and go out and do good works. Now, it's been my pleasure and my privilege to discuss these notions with you in these 4 seminars. I hope we'll have additional opportunities to collaborate. I appreciate it very much. I'm going to move us to discussion mode if there are any questions or comments that you have. Any comments or questions or clarifications about anything from this seminar or previous that you'd like to highlight or to ask? Well, I want to encourage you and those of you who are not attending, if there's something you want to clarify or ask or add to anything we've talked about, I welcome that very much. And if I can be of help to you, I hope you'll let me know. Thank you very much for your participation in this series and the responses that you've given that have helped shape some of the comments. I hope it was applicable and useful to you and that